Thank you, Ginny. Let me say those last few lines again. The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall. Their flowers, the tenderness of patient minds, and each slow dusk, a drawing down of blinds. I love these lines of poetry. I love them deeply. At first glance or at first hearing, the imagery might be hard to follow, hard to fully experience. Let me share just that last line again. And each slow dusk, a drawing down of blinds. What could be more evocative of mourning, of grief, of the absence of a young soldier who has gone to war and not returned? There's the slow dusk, the end of day, not a glorious dramatic sunset, but a slow dusk, a gradual darkening, a shadow moving across the landscape. And then the drawing down of blinds, the act of separation, of putting darkness, death perhaps, out of view, and thus saying a final goodbye to the loved one while retreating into the comfort of home and hearth. Each slow dusk, a drawing down of blinds. These words by Wilfred Owen take on even greater resonance when you know his story, which I'm going to share a bit of with you. When I hear the words, I imagine his mother at that window in a quiet English village, looking out on that slow, dusky landscape, and then drawing down the blind herself, because there's no longer a reason to watch the road, because she knows her son won't be coming home. Wilfred Owen died in France on November 4th, 1918, a week before the armistice that ended World War I. He died a century and a week ago today. You see his picture on the screens. He was a remarkable young man, just 25 years old when he died. He showed early promise as a poet, writing romantic sonnets and the like. Then he found himself in the trenches of World War I. Without exaggeration, a living hell. He suffered a severe concussion in one battle. Later, he was blown into the sky by an exploding shell and landed in a crater where he lay imprisoned beside the dismembered body of a comrade for hours until he could be rescued. He was given medical leave to recover from what was then called neurasthenia, and which today we would likely call post-traumatic stress disorder. It was during his treatment at Craig Lockhart Hospital in Edinburgh, Scotland, where the night halls were filled with the screams of men waking from nightmares, that Wilfred Owen became a poet. He began to write about the war, about the truth of the war. And in one of those fateful, blessed, beshert moments in life, Wilfred Owen came in contact with a fellow patient, an established poet, a mentor, a friend, eventually a lover, a soldier named Siegfried Sassoon. Sassoon challenged and nurtured Owen in the 10 short weeks they shared at Craig Lockhart. The result was a growing list of new or newly revised poems like the one you heard that Ginny shared, Anthem for Doomed Youth. It was a time of enormous growth for Owen, launching him into work that far exceeded anything Sassoon himself would write. One of those poems written at Craig Lockhart, perhaps Owen's most famous and harrowing, takes us directly into the trenches. Shells are falling. There is the constant possibility of being overcome by a cloud of poisonous gas. Owen captures the moment when a soldier, nearly dead from exhaustion, recognizes the danger signs too slowly, but struggles into one of the newfangled gas masks recently invented for the birth of chemical warfare. The poem's title is Latin, Dulce et decorum est, which means it is sweet and fitting. You'll hear the phrase used ironically at the end of the poem, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. Join me as Wilfred Owen takes us into the trenches as his men return from battle. Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on bloodshot, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas, gas, quick, boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil's, sick of sin, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friends, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Owen tells us that this idea that it's sweet and honorable to die for one's country is a lie told to unsuspecting children. And yet, not only did he do precisely that, die for his country, he went a bit further. He died in order to tell the truth, to tell the truth to us in this room. Wilfred Owen was discharged from Craig Lockhart Hospital in November of 1917 and could easily have accepted a desk job that would keep him safe in England until the end of the war. Indeed, he was assigned to an administrative post at a training camp in Scarborough, but he insisted on returning to the front for two reasons. First, he felt he could be useful to the men he'd left behind. He felt responsible to them. He was a good leader, an officer that others looked to for guidance and support and kindness. That they were fighting a pointless war didn't change the fact that the soldiers themselves were in need. Second, Owen knew that his poetry, which spoke so powerfully against the war, would be dismissed, even mocked, if he were not in the thick of the fighting himself. In order to give power to his poetry, in order to be heard, he had to prove his own courage. And so he returned to active duty in France on September 1st, 1918. He was awarded the Military Cross on October 1st for courage in battle. And he wrote this to his mother on October 8th. You will understand I could not write when you think of us for days all but surrounded by the enemy. All one day, we could not move from a small trench, though hour by hour the wounded were groaning just outside. Three stretcher bearers who got up were hit, one after one. I had to order no one to show himself after that, but remembering my own duty, and remembering also my forefathers, the agile Welshmen of the mountains, I scrambled out myself and felt an exhilaration in baffling the machine guns by quick bounds from cover to cover to cover. After the shells we had been through and the gas, bullets were like the gentle rain from heaven. Gentle rain from heaven. On November 4th, Wilfred Owen was killed, leading his men across the Sambre Canal into enemy fire. I've stood at that spot, on the banks of the Sambre Canal. I've knelt before Owen's gravestone in the tiny French village of Ors. It was some 13 years ago. I was traveling with my sister and my father. My mother had died the year before. We were visiting the sites where my grandfather had fought in World War I when he was 19. Places my father had been hearing about his whole life. When the concierge at our little hotel in Paris learned of our purpose, he bowed to my father and said, "My respects to you, sir." And Gil Legan, the historian who guided us through the exact spots near Chateau Thierry where my grandfather had fought and fallen and been rescued, he said, "I am always remembering what your countrymen did for mine. It is something we must not forget." Unbelievable, so beautiful. And such a gift to my father, to hear his father so honored. But I also had a personal pilgrimage to make. So early one morning, I left my father and sister sleeping in the hotel in Arras, hopped in the rental car, and drove alone through torrential rain to the place where Wilfred Owen lived his final days and where he died. With your indulgence, I'd like to share a brief excerpt from an essay of mine, a memoir. It'll be published tomorrow morning in the Tin House Literary Review in recognition of this centennial. In it, I write, "The rain was heavy and the E15 endlessly detoured onto country lanes that were themselves blocked by tractors that tripled the length of my estimated driving time. Arriving in Ors at last, I found the village streets empty and the gray walls running with water. The sign for the British cemetery pointed directly into a well-occupied cow pasture. I climbed three stiles and maneuvered past wide-eyed limousines before finding the secluded spot, defined by a well-trimmed hedge and marked by one of the sword-like crosses that dot the Somme Valley. Before entering the cemetery, I strode to the bank of the nearby canal, scrambling through leafy trees to emerge on a muddy two-track road that ran along the water. It was here that Owen was shot and killed, helping his men construct a bridge while under heavy fire. I imagine the deafening barrage of artillery, the cries of men driven to kill. Comrades who visited Owen's mother after the armistice described him patting them on the back and saying, "Well done," or "You are doing well, my boy." The words must have been screamed to be heard. End of quote. It's interesting to think about even the remote possibility of my grandfather and Wilfred Owen crossing paths in France in that year of 1918. It's interesting to think of the messages I received from each of them during my own formative adolescence. I first met Wilfred Owen in an English literature class during my sophomore year in high school when we read Anthem for Doomed Youth and Dulce et Decorum Est. His voice, Wilfred Owen's voice, lifted up against the evils of war just a few years after Vietnam. It was clear and strong and contemporary. My grandfather, who was wounded 100 miles south of the Sambre Canal, spoke for most of his life with a great sense of military pride and with flag-waving patriotism. In his later years, when his mind was loosening a bit and his filters and defenses were weakening, he was a bit more honest. We were home alone one afternoon, just the two of us. He told me for the first time about running across a field, stooped over, racing directly into German fire. He told me about glancing to his left to check on his best friend, a buddy from Iowa. He told me about seeing that friend's head blown away. And he told me with tears on his cheeks, never go to war, no matter what. In the end, both men, Wilfred Owen and the elder Norman Allen, offered me the same message, the same core truth. The people in the trenches, the people on the front lines, are astonishing, brave, deeply caring of each other. They are comrades, friends, people to fight for and fight beside. The enemy, the bad guy, is war itself, and the people who generate it, for their own ends, for the sake of their own egos. World War I, perhaps more than any other conflict in history, was waged to nurse the egos of powerful, privileged men who never put their own lives or their families or their wealth at stake. Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon and others like them couldn't remain silent in the face of such an outrage. Even before his death, Owen had begun to build a reputation as a poet to watch. A few of his poems had been published, and he had started drafting an introduction to a planned collection of his work. In that draft, he writes, "This book is not about heroes. English poetry is not yet fit to speak about them. Nor is it about deeds or land, nor anything about glory, honor, might, majesty, dominion, or power. Just war. Above all, I am not concerned with poetry. My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity." For Owen, the poetry seems also to be in the people. He finds poetry in Sassoon, whom he loves so deeply. He finds it in his mother, who was his friend and confidant. He finds it in the men he led and protected and died for. I'd like to close with Wilfred Owen's last letter home. It's the evening. Owen and his men have found a warm spot to settle for the night. And he writes, "Dearest mother, I will call the place from which I'm now writing the smoky cellar of the forester's house. So thick is the smoke in this cellar that I can hardly see by a candle 12 inches away. And so thick are the inmates that I can hardly write for the pokes, nudges, and jolts. On my left, the company commander snores on a bench. Other officers repose on wire beds behind me. At my right hand, Kellett, a delightful servant of A Company in the old days, radiates joy and contentment from pink cheeks and baby eyes. He laughs with a signaler to whose left ear is glued the receiver, but whose eyes, rolling with gaiety, show that he is listening with his right ear to a merry corporal who appears at this distance away, some 3 feet, nothing but a gleam of white teeth and a wheeze of jokes. Splashing my hand, an old soldier with a walrus mustache peels and drops potatoes into the pot. By him, Keys, my cook, chops wood. Another feeds the smoke with the damp wood. It is a great life. I am more oblivious than, alas, yourself, dear mother, of the ghastly glimmering of the guns outside and the hollow crashing of the shells. There is no danger here, or if any, it will be well over before you read these lines. I hope you are as warm as I am, as serene in your room as I am here. Of this I am certain, you could not be visited by a band of friends half so fine as surround me. Ever, Wilfred. Of this I am certain, you could not be visited by a band of friends half so fine as surround me here. Amen.